Hey gals, ghouls, and baddest days of the world, Cass here. And no, we did not release an episode last month, but if you've been listening to us for a while, you know how we roll. Expect double the trouble this month, if not triple the treats to make up for it. And before we kick off this episode on urban legends, I want to let you know to stay tuned to the end of the episode where Ryan will go through why he picked what musical interludes that he made. He goes into the Devil's Chord history and some other just creeptastic guitar riffing facts that I think y'all want to hear. And he's been great so far with his music, and I want to keep hearing more of it on the pod. So share your love if you feel the same way too. And let's get into all the stories that we shouldn't listen to in the darkest of night, but we can't help repeating. Welcome back, gals, ghouls, and baddest days of the world. I am your co-host, Cass Clark. And as always, I'm joined by my lovely co-host, Ryan C. Bradley.
Hello.
And today we have a triple threat. We have the lovely co-hosts of Scarred Her Life podcast, now officially on the Dread Podcast Network, Mary Woo! Beth McAndrews and Terry. Would you love to introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure. I'll go first. I've been on the show before. I'm Mary Beth McAndrews. I'm editor-in-chief of Dread Central. Also co-host with Terry on the Scarred For Life podcast, which, as Cass says, on the Dread Central Podcast Network, where we talk to a guest, usually a horror film director, writer, someone in the horror space, about a film that terrified them as a kid. And we've had some really awesome guests. It's been really fun. People are scared of some crazy stuff, and we've gotten to relive some of our traumatic childhood experiences too. Terry, you want to add anything to that?
No, I mean, she covered it pretty well. But, I'm Terry Menard. I'm the editor-in-chief of Gaily Dreadful, and yeah, the co-host of Scar for Life.
Yeah, I can vouch that the podcast is great. I guessed it on it actually talking about the movie Urban Legend, and today we decided we're going to talk about urban legends and horror.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Don't we have one more guest?
We do have one more guest. How could I forget my spouse? I did. It happened in real time. I'm doing the dishes later now. So.
Are we editing this out or keeping this in? So I think we should keep this in.
We're definitely keeping it in.
I think it's beautiful. I love it.
So Chris Poole, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, everybody. My name's Chris. I'm a writer and teacher in the Boston area. Mm-hmm. And I am a very amateur enthusiast of urban legends. I don't have any particular expertise to bring, but I think they're really neat.
Mm-hmm. Very humble, I see. Very humble.
He's been teaching like a unit on this forever. And I can like vouch for the fact, like I'll be like somewhere in the house and be like, oh, well, really, you can't just say a folklore is an urban legend or a myth and like it just spouts off some beautiful gems. So hopefully we get one or two of them on here.
I'm happy to help out with some book nerd stuff in this movie podcast.
So Chris, what defines an urban legend and how is it different from folklore?
Well, I would base all those definitions on one influential book, at least for me, which is The Vanishing Hitchhiker by Jan Harald Brundtland. Which was very, very popular in the early 80s. It was like published in 1981. And this is kind of like the popular history that really kind of blew up the study of urban legends. And I think he does a pretty good job of kind of delineating these definitions. So like folklore would probably be our biggest umbrella, right? Like it's just in the most simple terms, it's the lore of folks, right? It's just any oral tradition that's just passed among people. So the next stage would be like, well, is it narrative folklore? And that would be any folklore that actually just tells a story. A subcategory of narrative folklore would be a legend, which is, you know, anything that is told as if it is true, right? Like this really happened. And then the final version for us would be urban legends, which are just legends set more in the modern contemporary era. I find it interesting too that in the notes of Alvin Schwartz's Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, he actually has like a whole bunch of like academic notes in the back of like all of his research into this. He does not refer to them as urban legends. He refers to them as migratory belief legends and like bases that in the work of like several other scholars.
That's like actually really cool because I didn't really know how to define an urban legend recently. Like, wait, hold on. So that's actually very helpful in terms of like figuring, delineating. Every day's a school day.
So one of the questions I had while I was researching, do cryptids and alien encounters go under urban legends or are they their own weird thing.
Based on those definitions, I would put them under like the category of like general folklore. But since like a legend has to be a story, like you need it to have that like narrative engine for it to be a legend.
So what's like the, I guess, the tenets?
At least according to Brunvand, like he calls out these like three essential elements to a good urban legend. First off, it has to have a strong basic story appeal. And I think this is probably the most important, right? That like there's always those twists at the end. Like there's like a hook, characters. There's a hook figuratively or literally, oftentimes literally. But yeah, it has to be a fun story that is worth sharing, right? Because this is all like oral tradition too. Like it doesn't work if people don't want to share the stories together. So like you need that basic entertainment value. So like to go back to your question, Ryan, right? Like Bigfoots and cryptids, like maybe they could be part of urban legends, but they'd have to be in a story, right? Like you want to tell a story.
An urban legend is more of like an actual story rather than a figure. And then the urban legends like will incorporate those figure. Oh.
So you could have a Bigfoot urban legend, but would have to be like
the hook specific incidents.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you, like all of a sudden you were in, like you went camping in the woods and you, your boyfriend was in the tent. You went to get a drink of water and came back. Now your boyfriend's Bigfoot.
Yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking, Cass. Yeah. Your boyfriend magically turned into Bigfoot.
Every time I go camping,
I end up with a cryptid boyfriend. Darn it. What's Steve going to become when we go camping? I can see why Chris is a teacher. This is actually very helpful and very...
Well, the other two, so if the first one's like, it's got to be a story, right? Number one. The second is that it has a foundation and actual belief. So like, that's that sort of famous quality of urban legends where it's always like, oh no, like not only did this really happen, but I like distantly know, but don't know who this happened to. Like it's my brother's, my mom's friend's cousin's uncle, next town over. Like it's really tantalizingly close so that it has that extra appeal, but there's like just enough remove that you're like, well, I don't actually know this person, but it definitely happened.
Is the belief based in the teller believing it, or is the belief based on the teller trying to convince the receiver that it happened?
More the latter, right? Because the real drive is like that appeal to like it did actually happen. Part of telling the story and part of the fun of the story is like convincing people that at the very least it could happen, but I'm trying to convince you it definitely did happen. And that's kind of part of the scary story appeal. Yeah. I think that it can get murky whether or not the person telling actually believes, but that's usually the case.
Or you're told so young that you believe it. Like I definitely, and I still kind of believe it, even though it's probably not true at all. And I think this will come up in Ryan's notes because I had uncles that were like in Miami and told me there were alligators in the toilet. And I was like, no, they told me. Like I even said it once as like a 30 something and I paused. I was like, wait a second, hold on. But like, I still can't because I heard it so young. My brain is just like, yeah, that was true, right?
There were actually alligators flushed down the toilets. I don't know if they like created alligator civilizations down there, as seems to be implied by urban legends, but they were definitely flushed. I think they probably just died and it was irresponsible pet ownership. Yeah. It's like way sadder than the alligator civilization.
No, it's the third tenet.
It's going to have at least what Brunvand called a meaningful message or moral. But what I like about that is that this gets kind of layered too, because there's that first obvious layer where all of these legends are really like straightforward warnings. Like, do not go to make out point, you unwed teens. Like... don't trust strangers, don't get into like dangerous scenarios or go off on your lonesome as like a young woman, all these sort of like lowercase c, like watch out warnings. But there's also this way where the stories kind of look back on the community that shares it and really responds to it. So what we can find really interesting about urban legends is like, what does it tell us about us as an audience or the other members of the audience who like to share it, that this is the story that really appeals. And at the end of the introduction to The Vanishing Hitchhiker, I really like that author brings up these like two questions to kind of ask if you really want to like dig deep and study urban legends. And those questions are, what are the standards of behavior that the characters in legends either conform to or disregard? And do the messages of legends support or attack society's expectations?
Ooh. That's definitely going to come up when we talk about Candyman.
I was going to say, I'm already thinking about how that applies to the movies we're talking about.
Cool.
Before we get into the movies, does everyone want to say their favorite urban legend?
I was trying to think of if Omaha, which is where I live, Omaha, Nebraska, had any. And there are some that we have. I don't know necessarily if they meet all the tenants, but there is one. There's a place in Omaha called Hummel Park, and there's been a book written about it, The Legend of Hummel Park and Other Stories, and it is kind of a catch-all for a variety of those sort of urban legends that you hear in other areas, but like it's more centralized. So like some people said there was an albino feral farm on it, or there were satanic ritual murders, or that there was lynching and now the ghosts haunt the place. Like there is very different stories all centered around this park, which was a place where people would go and make out, right? Like it's like, so it almost feels like a don't go to this park at night because the albino feral creatures might get you. Like that's so that's been one of my favorites. And one of the ones I always remember growing up would be that, you know, someone's cousin or someone's brother went to this haunted house and each floor got progressively worse so that they could like attack you at some point, and you pay $50, but if you can get up to the top, you win a lot of money, but no one ever makes it up to the top. And so there's always like those types of things. But yeah, Hummel Park is probably my favorite of the ones that are of my area.
Love that.
I think my favorite that I had growing up was like the creepy old house behind our elementary school. So where I grew up, there was like an old plantation, because I grew up in Maryland, and whatever Marylanders want to say about our place and that, we had a lot of plantations in the state of Maryland. And where I grew up, there was an old dilapidated plantation behind our elementary school. Weird as shit, I know, but like it was there. Like all of my soccer practices were like old, like the fields right next to it. And so everyone had a story about going into it and finding a dead body in the basement, about there being ghosts there. And so I would hang out outside of it, but I would never go in. Got bad vibes from the woods. I don't know if that was anxiety or what, but I never went in. I went there all the time with my friends and we would dare each other to go in, but I never did it. And now they have like restored it and made it this like beautiful like community garden space, but I still don't fuck with it.
What about you, Ryan?
When I was a kid, there is this weird rumor, urban legend thing, that Marilyn Manson cut out his own rib with a butter knife.
Oh. Oh, yeah.
So he could suck his own dick. It seems like very easily disproven, but I think it's still an urban legend.
I believed that for an embarrassing amount of time, I will tell you.
Same.
I definitely believe that. I think someone recently told me he actually did. I think he might have started it himself.
Maybe. The butter knife detail is so weird.
The butter knife detail is weird.
How are you going to cut through a bone with a butter knife?
Wait, okay, hold on. I had to Google it because apparently an unknown internet user just like said that he did it. And I think it kind of just spread like wildfire. Again, the beauty of urban legends. So they thought it was
like,
real.
This was like before I was on the internet that I heard it. I was like fourth grade, like riding the bus. We didn't know what sucking dick was and we were talking about it.
Fair.
Put on my nerd glasses again for a second. Ryan, actually, you categorized that perfectly. That is a type of folklore called rumor, where there's just like, did you hear that this thing? It's not like a story, but it is like a memorable like event or occurrence.
No.
You can't really tell the story, like unless you want to get into really graphic detail. Like you're not really telling like the whole arc of the story of him cutting his rib out with that butter knife. But like that's very much related to what we're talking about. It's interesting, for as much as I'm like into urban legends, I didn't have like the natural relationship with it, like where you just share it with a bunch of friends. What I shared with friends in elementary school was the scary story books, right? Yeah. Which were like the like whispered about artifact, like most checked out in the library, like everybody's poring over the illustrations until your time runs out and you have to give it to somebody else. Mm-hmm. So like our like urban legend experience is so much colored from those particular tellings. But like what was interesting is that it still was this like shared experience. Like everyone's talking about like, oh, did you read this one? Or do you remember like this illustration on this page? Because there's a lot of them to flip through. Right. It's I have all three.
Yeah.
Yeah. All three.
Can't prepare.
Oh yeah. I love these books. They still These talk about like scarred for life.
Same. Oh, yeah. That was my Same. Aunt had those books as like when I was a kid, and I didn't like, I thought they were like cursed objects because of the terrifying illustrations.
Incredibly terrifying. But yeah.
I just want to see the fetus with a root now.
Wait, I'm gonna find it. Oh, this one has the best illustrations. The first one, hands down.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. I can't really think of one right now. I feel like I've talked about some of them before on actually on Scarred for Life, but Mercy Brown, the vampire in Newport. That one is probably one of my favorites. I think like my favorite part about that one is that the belief that if like a gravestone is cracked or tilted or off kilter in any way, which is really just because of like grave robbing and like poverty in the 19th century and 18th century. But if you saw like a cracked grave, it meant that a vampire was underneath there. And that was like one of the things that like people thought about Mercy Brown and that she raised from the dead when she was just sick. But I love that idea of like, even now when I'm walking through a graveyard, if I see like a slightly cracked or tilted headstone, I'm just like, ooh, maybe they came out to play and then went back to sleep. Yep. Still gets me.
Very cool. Let's segue into some movies. The earliest I found is from 1938, a German flick, Covered Tracks. It dramatizes the classic urban legend of someone who goes to a hotel and they leave. And when they come back, it's basically a completely different hotel and you can't find the person you left there. In the case of this movie, it was a daughter leaves her older mother and no one has any memory of seeing the mother. 1950, So Long at the Fair, deals with the same urban legend 12 years later. 1951, Return to Glenniscoll, aka Orson Welles' Ghost Story, is a short film. It's more of a historical oddity than like a featured list item. 1974, we got The First Black Christmas, and this is dealing with the call is coming from inside the house urban legend. Mm. It got remakes, and we covered all three in our Christmas special last year. 1977, Secrets of the Gods / The Force Beyond is a documentary about urban legends, specifically focusing in on alien abductions and Bigfoot. 1979, When a Stranger Calls, great horror movie starring Carol Kane, inspired the opening phone call scene from Scream. It got a sequel in 93 and a remake in 06, also dealing with the calls coming from inside the house. 1980, one of Cass's favorite urban legends, the crocodile, the alligators being flushed down the toilet, getting too big. And this movie was Robert Foster starring Alligator, which got a sequel in 91. 1988, Night of the Demons uses the razor blade in Candy urban legend at the very end, which is a little bit of a spoiler, but also kind of like not part of the plot of the movie the way it's in there. 1990, the Hook of Woodland Heights deals with the famous Hook Hand Killer. 1991, Campfire Tales. Gunnar Hansen and friends tell scary stories around a campfire, including some urban legends, which got a sequel in 97. 1991, Popcorn.
Yeah! Pause. Yeah. Pause. I watched it for the first time last night with Chris. It is so good. It is so good. Terry, I know you also love this movie, so please share why you love this movie so much.
I don't. It just, it's a meta slasher before like we get Scream, and it's set in a movie theater, and there's Wild Movies that celebrates the like William Castle of it all back in the day. And it's just, it's a delight. It's campy. It's fun. Has a great killer reveal. Yeah, I love it.
Excellent performance by that bad guy too. That's good stuff.
It's so good. Okay.
I was scrolling X last night. Everyone but me who's here today tweeted about how much they liked this movie last night. And I was like, what is going on? Did y'all have like a party? All right. After Popcorn in 1992, we got Candyman, which is a Clive Barker penned film starring Tony Todd as the titular villain. It had sequels.
Wait, what was the movie again?
I think you have to start over now.
Yeah, don't get this again, don't you?
scored sequels in 95 and 99, as well as a requel in 2021. We'll talk about it a bunch. It's our first breakout film. 1997, I Know What You Did Last Summer, peak Kevin Williamson being the writer in horror films, got sequels in 98 and a direct-to-DVD sequel in 2006. 1998, we got The Last Broadcast, which is early found footage about a film crew being murdered while searching for the Jersey Devil. 1998, we got Urban Legend as well, and yes. Y'all talked about that a bunch on Scarred for Life. It has an all-star cast and got sequels in 2000 and 2005. 1998, also had two movies about the same premise, The Curve and Dead Man Campus, both about the urban legend that you will get straight A's if your roommate dies by suicide at a college. 1999, we got The Blair Witch Project, a classic that we covered with Mary Beth on our found footage episode. That got sequels in 2000, 2016. 2000, we had Shadow of the Vampire, where Willem Dafoe stars as Max Schreck in a meta take on Nosferatu. 2002, The Mothman Prophecies, starring Richard Gere and Laura Linney. And they act out a series of cryptid sightings that end in a real-life tragedy in West Virginia. Huh. 2003, Wishing Stairs, which is one that Cass loves.
I do love this one. It's very tragic, and it's one of my, I guess it is probably one of my favorite urban legends, but it's not like local to me or anything, but it's come up in different cultures all the time. And it's the idea that like the 13th step on any staircase has some sort of magical property that like, if you go up the staircase, and there used to be a creepypasta about this too, sort of where it was like, there's a staircase in the woods. And if you go up the staircase at a certain time, like another step will appear. And if that step appears and you step on it and you like make your wish will come true. And there's a version of that creepypasta where it's like you go up the staircase and if you like climb it at the right time, you can like go to another dimension or something. And it really was just like, that one was like built out of the idea that it was just like urban redevelopment stuff where just people like stopped building houses in certain areas. And so you would have staircases that were just there, but people made legends around it. But yeah, Wishing Stairs is a phenomenal film. It's very, very sad, but I highly recommend it. It's about two girls in a art school and they're both trying to compete for like the premier stop of being like the best ballerina. And it's definitely a queer love story and their competition kind of tears them apart.
I'm also glad you brought up creepypastas because I was not sure what to do with them for this list. Because they seem like, for one and two of Chris's definition, are very much like urban legends. Mm. So I'm not sure if they would count, but I didn't count them. I kind of counted them as their own thing.
I think when we get to our second, so when we get to our second breakout film, I feel like it will be impossible to not talk about creepypasta.
For sure. All right, so in 2004, we got Shudder. It's horror from Thailand focusing on the imperfections in printed photos. I found it interesting because it was remade in Telugu, Tamil, English, and Hindi. So kind of just all over India and America, it got remade again and again. 2006, Bloody Mary, about the classic urban legend. And I'm curious, did any of y'all ever try the Bloody Mary incantation?
Oh, yeah.
Nah, dude.
See, Terry likes to fuck with this stuff. Terry loves, like, testing fate. And I am the opposite. I would run away if anyone tried to do that to me. Like, my friends would, like, lock me in the bathroom to try to get me to do it. And, like, with the lights off. And I was, like, a notorious scaredy cat. So, like, I never did it. I was like, I don't want to know. I don't want to fucking find out what happens if you do that. Like, who knows?
See, I would have been your friend. I would have been your friend.
Yeah, I know, asshole. And then I would have thrown a spider on you and it would have been mean.
In 2007, we got Trick or Treat, which uses many urban legends. Cass and I recorded a commentary track on this one for Halloween. 2007 also had Teeth. I didn't realize Vagina Dentata was not made up for the movie. Apparently, it was an urban legend. I'm just curious, did any of you hear of it as an urban legend before that movie came out?
I knew about the razor blade in vaginas during World War II to dissuade like soldiers, US soldiers from having sex with like Japanese women. That was like really dark, but and it's not true. But that was something that they would tell soldiers because they were afraid of like sympathizing with Japanese cultures and that. But I think there's versions of that, yeah.
You were nodding your head. Had you heard of it before?
I had, yeah. I don't remember where or why or how, but I did know before the movie. Because I was like, oh, they're making a movie about that? But I have no context for it. It was something people, I guess, talked about. Okay. Weirdly enough.
I just loved that movie and made everyone watch it when it came out. So I, like, made everyone in my, I made all of the the romantic interests in my life terrified of Vagina Dentata when I was in high school. Because I made all of the guys I had crushes on watch it with me.
All right, 2012, we're skipping a little bit. The ABCs of Death and its 2014 sequel do not shy away from the gory urban legends. 2014, It Follows, which I'm sure some folks will disagree with me, but that creature seems to be absolutely an urban legend in that world. 2014 also had Killer Legends, a documentary on urban legends and their possible origins. 2016 had Perak, The Shadow Over Prague, about the Golem of Prague. Mm-hmm. 2017 had The Mimic, a Korean horror film about a creature that imitates humans. 2018 had Field Guide to Evil, which sounds absolutely amazing. It's an anthology horror film where eight filmmakers from eight different countries dramatized the urban legends from their country.
Whoa, I definitely want to see that. That sounds cool.
Yeah, it sounds very, very cool. 2018 also had Butterfly Kisses, which is our second breakout film. We'll talk about it a bunch in a little bit. 2018 also had Antrim, which is a horror mockumentary about a lost film. Mm-hmm. And Stree, a Hindi comedy horror about the Come Tomorrow ghost, who's also the subject of Jayaprakash Satyamurthy's book, Come Tomorrow. 2019, we had the film adaptation of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, directed by Andre Overdahl and produced by Guillermo del Toro. And 2022, Urban Myths, which is a Korean anthology folk horror film. We've seen a ton of anthology horror films on here. I'm curious, what about urban legends lend themselves to anthology horror films? Do y'all think?
I think because it's mostly about like a gag, right? Like there's just that moment. And so it's kind of hard to create a sustained story about what it amounts to being a joke, almost like the hook was on the car, or the call was from inside the house, or the, you know, there's a razor in the candy. Like it feels like that it lends itself to anthology level of storytelling.
I also think there's such a familiarity with all those stories. Like there's a universality to a lot of them. Mm-hmm. Like they're short, but they're relatable. And so you can, even if you're just using them as a base and building on top of that, I think that there's something that is so appealing about those because everyone's heard a version of them. And I think people get so excited to see urban legend, like urban legends on screen. I feel like people get excited, especially if they're like local or if they're super universal. And so I think that also probably has something to do with it as well.
Yeah. And there's something too about like, if one of the main, like thinking back on like the, if one of the main tenets of urban legends is it being a story that's good. I think one part of what makes a story good is it being easy to tell and to pass on quickly. So I feel like sometimes the anthology format and having like a short films just lend themselves to being able to tell that story quicker and like in a more condensed way. So it travels faster. At least that's what I think. What do you think?
I would probably even just piggyback on Terry's point that like it is really hard to sustain the kind of like hooky, gotcha, twisty moments of good urban legends. Like that appeals so much in that sort of short format. Mm-hmm. Like, and even things like Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, like that itself is like an anthology. Like it's like short little stories that you share. You know, Cass, I was talking to you when we were looking at this list last night. I'm like, you know, I've never seen When a Stranger Calls, because every time I'm like, how do you sustain that for a whole movie? I guess they do it, but like,
have you, it's When a Stranger Calls is great.
I know. Yeah. I was like, there's so much tension. And he's like, but like,
how? Yeah, I'm amazed.
I know.
I've still got to see it.
But the movie, like the first act is the urban legend, and the second and third act are a continuation of that story, not really the not really the same urban legend still,
unless you watch the 2006 remake, and you really shouldn't.
You shouldn't.
Yeah, even the urban legend movie is just like, let's just string all of these urban legends together and just kind of cycle through them all, right? Like it takes I think extra effort to have like one legend over a feature-length film than it is to do multiple.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the closest we get to that was like, I Know What You Did Last Summer. Mm-hmm. So it can be done, but like, I don't know. I'm not sure if it's ever been done that successfully or a whole film.
This is an abbreviated history, and we'll have the full history on my Patreon. We're experimenting with our format. So let us know on Twitter what you think of the shorter histories with the long history elsewhere. Cass, are you ready to take us through our first film?
What's it called?
Candyman.
Mm-mm, don't.
Candyman?
What was it again?
1992's Candyman, written and directed.
One more time. I'm sorry.
Stop. I mean,
it's that film written and directed by Bernard Rose. I think it's called Candyman. The Far So Safe. I think. So it's technically based on Clive Barker's short story, The Forbidden, but Rose also weaved in some other elements like the Bloody Mary mirror urban legend and some really disturbing real life facts about the Chicago Housing Authority, which we will definitely get to. The film stars Virginia Madsen as Helen Lyle, the Tony Todd as Candyman, and Cassie Lemons as Bernadette. The film follows Helen and Bernadette's exploration into the belief that Candyman is this figure, mythological or real, haunting Chicago's Cabini Green housing projects. People fear the hook-handed figure, but why? Of course, the more Helen investigates, the more she puts herself and the entire housing community at a deadly crossroads. Oh, and she also has a shitty husband with a shitty subplot I could do without. So
I forget that she's married.
It's so dumb. The only good part about it is that, like, huge spoiler, so pause if you haven't seen 1992's Candyman, but like he gets super slaughtered and it's delicious. But other than that, I don't.
Yes.
I don't care. Just like an interesting quote that I think, like listening to us all talk about this, I think that if I had any doubt in my mind that the movie Candyman wasn't its own urban legend, aside from like the actual story in the movie, like I don't anymore. And I think this quote from Rose, an interview with Den of Geek in like 2020 or so, pretty much like hits a nail on the head. But like what he wanted the intent for the movie to be, he was saying that all these people believe in the Candyman, which actually means the Candyman exists. Whereas if they stop believing in him, he disappears. Like how the old deities, like the Roman gods, died because people stopped caring. The idea that if enough people believe something, they manifest it. That's scary. And I think like even...
Tolpas.
Very Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, but I think even in this podcast so far, like we're all joking around it, but we're all definitely nervous. Every time we say Candyman, everyone's just like,
yes,
no, please don't.
Not me.
Harry is the like, fucking show. So
I'm ready to summon him. Let's go.
But like it is so wild to me. I'm sorry. Is that okay if I talk about
it? No, go for it.
It's
just
so wild that Candyman like wasn't really a thing before this movie and then it became a thing.
Yeah.
And I think that is so cool, like so fucking cool, like with how legends work and urban legends and how like, yeah, obviously it has that Bloody Mary aspect and it's already built on existing urban legendary, but then it expanded because of technology, which I think we'll get into with butterfly kisses. But like, I'm really interested in digital folklore and like how that expands. And while this is a little bit more pre-internet, I think it is a really interesting precursor to how belief through media can be perpetuated in such fascinating ways and how they permeate. Like, generations of us fucking believe Candyman's gonna come out of the mirror. Like, I grew up with that. So it's really, really cool how these things permeate like cultural consciousness, even if there's no other thing other than a movie. It's just neat. It's cool.
Yeah, I think it's a great example of the early phase of like the mass mediaization of urban legend.
Yeah.
Usually just passed through communities. Like I talked about my own experience with like mainly experiencing them through scary stories. Like Brunvand did that too. Like both of these like texts coming up in the 80s and then into the early 90s. And we kind of see that at the beginning of Candyman too, right? Where we've got like the professor leading his like class to talk about urban legends. It's just a lot more kind of like widely spread right around this time.
Yeah, and that the book that you mentioned actually was one of the ways that like Rose used, like how he structured the screenplay was like that book. Can you say it again? Brunvand's
The Vanishing Hitchhiker.
The Vanishing Hitchhiker was one of the guiding forces of the script. So it's really great that you brought that up also.
I was listening to the commentary track as I watched the movie this time. Mm-hmm. And Clive Barker talked a lot about how people will critique him for like the things he missed about folklore. And he claims that he didn't read any of the stuff before he wrote The Forbidden, which this is the story Candyman's based on. And so he's always kind of mad and people are like, well, you messed up this portion of how this urban legend is supposed to work. He's like, I made it up. I completely made this from scratch.
They also completely, and I know we're going to talk about this, Jake, right now, they completely changed the context of Barker's story.
Yes, absolutely.
Into something much, I mean, I haven't read the Barker story in a long time, but it's way more complicated, I think, where they place the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I know that we're going to move into that. So
one of the big things that changed when Rose decided to adapt Barker's story is that he decided to move it from Liverpool into the Chicago housing project. So here we go. We can't talk about Candyman without talking about Chicago's Cabrini Green and the settling of Chicago as a city in general, because moving the location, there's a lot of implications that in some ways the film does explore in a really fruitful and intriguing way. In other ways, at least in my opinion, and I'm sure we'll get into it, I feel like it could have done something so much more and it just like shot itself in the foot in a lot of ways, which is really frustrating watching it now in a modernized context. So in the movie, one of the biggest cases when like Helen starts investigating, she hears about Ruth, the woman Ruth who was killed in the Cabrini Green housing projects. And the really sad thing is that was actually based on a real life story of a 52-year-old Black woman named Ruthie McCoy, who supposedly had schizophrenia. We don't know because this is also reported by the cops. Very ACAB here, so who knows? But she was known to call into the cops for help. That much is true. And so on one night she was calling a lot, saying there was somebody like in her wall, someone coming through the medicine cabinet, and they just wrote it off because of her history of supposed mental illness or labeled mental illness on their part. And the woman ended up getting shot and died. And they did find that that similar to the movie that where we see where they didn't actually reinforce walls between the apartment buildings. There were ways that you could just like push out through the medicine cabinet to like get in to other people's apartments. And that actually did happen to her. And so in the movie too, which is like really dark, and I don't know how, I feel very complicated about this, especially in found footage, even though this isn't found footage and we'll get into that later. But when we use real archival documents in fiction, in the movie, when Helen's doing her research and is looking through articles about things that happened in the Cabrini-Green projects, one of the articles is actually like Ruth McCoy's, like the incident report is actually like real archival newspaper that they put in the film. So deep breath there.
Okay. So I have a lot of feelings too, because just like for a little bit of context, when I lived in Chicago, I lived near Cabrini Green. It's very different now, but I was going to grad school. I lived in south side of Chicago. I lived near-ish to Cabrini Green. I knew about Cabrini Green, but in the context of like Chicago really fucked it up. And I hadn't actually seen Candyman yet because I hadn't. And so when I went to grad school, I worked at an archive called Media Burn Archive. And I actually, a lot of what they did was like guerrilla filmmaking and documentary filmmaking in the 70s and 80s. And I learned a lot about Cabrini Green while I was working there, because I was like looking at all their documentaries and like looking and like cutting clips for their social media and kind of trying to be like, look at the political activism in Chicago. So I was like, I need to watch fucking Candyman, because I've been like watching these documentaries. And again, like I am a white woman. I was just watching these documentaries. I by no means fully understand, but I have like a teeny bit more just like understanding of that Cabrini Green. And I'm really glad I did, because like it really gives Candyman this like a little bit of ickiness even more to it with the context of what Cabrini Green is and all of the really fucked up things that have happened there, because cops would not come when people called. And
yeah,
like there were so many, especially Black women, trying to like keep the community alive. And then there was all these really bad things that happened when Cabrini Green went away, and how they relocated people, and this destruction, this decimation of community, like then that you're saying in this movie, they don't, that's so much more interesting than a white woman's like, what do I do? I go to University of Chicago, where I got my master's, which is hysterical. So I'm going to go to the projects and try to find a story. And that is a very frustrating part of this movie, because Cabrini, and I think, not to jump too far ahead, I think Nia DaCosta's Candyman tries to kind of rectify that a little bit. And it's really hard because that is decades of stuff. But it is kind of like, when you really know about Cabrini Green and what happened there for real, you get this ick watching this movie a little bit of like, no, this was like a real housing project, like a lot of issues. And like you said, Ruthie McCoy was a real woman who died here. And using her death in such an explicit way to create fear is, in the year of our Lord 2023, I know it's a little bit different. And when 1992, I know it was different, but still, like, it just puts a really weird like slime over the movie a little bit.
It does, especially because in the interviews, like I was reading through with Rose, like he was aware of what he was doing. And you can tell at certain points, because there are some points throughout the film where I'm like, oh, you're actually going to like tackle the subject in a way that I think could be really interesting.
Yeah.
But he goes on record all the time in interviews saying like he didn't want to politicize his movie. He didn't want it to have a thesis statement. And it's like, first of all, everything is political. But then why did you choose to use the most sensationalized aspects of the
Cabrini Green was like a national thing too. It wasn't like that. But also in the horror genre, you have a Black man be your villain, saying things like, be my victim. And he's a slave who was murdered because he was supposedly like having sex with a white woman. Like that's the most political shit you could do. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And if you don't see that,
you shouldn't be doing the movie.
And look, yes, we can all say 1992, but like these things were issues in 1992. And like, I think just trying to say, it's just that whole thing of like, I don't want my horror to be political. I'm like, then why'd you place it in a housing project in Chicago? You know what you're doing. I love Chicago with all of my heart, people get so shitty about that city, and it makes me so angry because it's so racist.
Well, to kind of continue with that, so I did find, when we had done this episode on Scarred for Life, I did go out and take a look at some articles to see if I could find stuff. And I do have two articles. One was from the Chicago Reader from 1987, and it is an in-depth exploration of what happened in the mirror that I can send you guys if you guys don't have it, if you want to include it with your notes. But it is like a very long read about what actually happened with... they came in through the bathroom mirror, which is the line that she says in the call. And then there was also, when the movie came out, there was an article from the Chicago Tribune from 1992 where there was a lot of Black filmmakers and a lot of taking issue with this film, right? Yeah. And so they had like some quotes from some of the stars, and we get this cringy quote from Virginia Madsen that says, "What's wrong with Candyman craving a white woman? That's not a stereotype. That's real. You know, the people who are most worried about this movie being racist are white. I find that amusing. To me, it's a love story with a Black phantom. The phantom is never allowed to be a Black man."
I think a lot of people, and honestly, whenever you're doing a requel, let's just be honest, I feel like the horror community will go harder if it's led by like a woman person of color. And I think Nia DaCosta's 2021's Candyman, I think it was really great. I also think that it was definitely, people didn't quite know how to react to it because it was definitely made by and for Black people and not like general horror community at large. And that's perfectly like great. But one thing I really loved about the production of it and like the making of it is like they put so much care into like when they were marketing the film. Even I remember like, because at the time I was like writing about it for work and I was like doing the live tweet event for the movie, they like made sure to include like educational resources in like the live tweet-a-thon and whatnot.
Yeah.
And one of the things I'll link to in the show notes is Candyman, the official companion guide, which if you like look up Candyman, the movie right now, you can go and you can find the entire, like, it's like this interactive companion guide that will like give you like Google treasure hunts to go down. We like just like enter in this question and like it would be something like, oh, who moved into Cabrini Green, and then like it will pull up all these articles that will then lead you down a rabbit hole for you to do your own like anti-racism work on like your own time. And definitely please do, listeners. But I delved into that. It's like it's pretty, it goes pretty quickly. It's like maybe a 70-page PDF, but like it's mostly interactive, so it's like something you can do in like a Sunday afternoon for sure. And just some like interesting tidbits that came out of it that I think are just important for this conversation, because it also helped me when I was rewatching Candyman last night to frame it in the context of like what Rose was or wasn't doing with this. So one thing that like in a lot of articles, when you start going down that rabbit hole about even to this day, like Black artists and educators and like and activists will like try to preserve like Chicago's Black history in certain areas, and people will say things like, well, there's not really any Black history here, this is a historically white area. And that's like a roadblock that a lot of like Black educators will face in certain areas. But one fact that I think people don't widely know is that the first settler of Chicago was a Black man named Jean-Baptiste Pointe-du-Sable in the 1700s. So like quite literally, Chicago is a founded by a Black man. It is a Black city, historically Black. So the idea that we ever use like the idea of like a segregationist mindset to ever talk about Chicago is just flawed in the start. And I think it's really interesting because when we watch 1992's Candyman, because like Mary Beth, like Chris was saying, we're watching it through this like scholarship lens of this white student going into this other area, it just objectifies this culture and community that has always been there, that will always be there. And it just like makes it feel like the other because of how the framework of the film is working in this like white lens way, which is again, just like, it could have been interesting if it was flipped on its head. And for a couple moments, like we see moments like Anne-Marie, when Anne-Marie talks back to Helen a couple times in the film, I feel like it gave us a suggestion of like, yes, let's engage. Like, why are we doing this? Like, why did we have to make this choice to have a white lens on this? Like, we could start off that way, but then are we going to reconcile with that? And from my opinion, it just doesn't. Throughout the 1840s, enslaved Black people migrated to Chicago. And by about 1870, there was about 3,000 Black settlers. Post-Civil War, there was a bigger boom in Black businesses. It then eventually led to the Great Migration. And all this is to say that like for a short time, Chicago was like a safe haven for Black communities to go to and cultures to thrive until, again, the 1950s happened. Civil rights warfare, let's just say, to be honest, happened. Around this time in the 1950s, Chicago Housing Authority decided to build the Cabrini Green Project. And the Chicago Housing Authority was supposed to be the housing project's landlord, is the easiest way to explain it. But the whole problem with that is they, by the 1960s, pretty much abandoned the projects and also decided to racially segregate the public housing in that area, which led to like the Cabrini Green, at least that we see like in the film, because there was a Cabrini Green that then like got torn down and then rebuilt to like a version of the Cabrini Green that we know in this film. And by that time, the housing was segregated. So only like low income people, who most often happen to be Black families, would live there. And the CHA was not doing anything. Like, there was no trash cleanup, there was no upkeep of the facilities. there was like no like water being like maintained, like hot water didn't often work. They also had like pest control issues, which is just a way of just saying that like when you ignore like housing complaints of people, your actual home gets like run down over time, like psychologically that has a horrible effect on anyone and just like increases desperation in people if they are like quite literally living in poverty, if like they are trying to like, I don't know, just have shelter and not having shelter is such a basic need and their actual shelter is breaking down. Like it just caused a huge spike in like violence-based crimes and drug activity in that area because of the economic risk of that. But because of that, people, and you'll see it in like archives, like through people just like sensationalize Black violence and be like, oh, look, urban blight, this is a thing. Like Black people are violent. It's like, no, it's the situations that we like systemically force them into. And in desperation, people will do what they need to survive. And when like the police force and city is pushing them aside, they're gonna look for any way to like oppress them and just really not look out for their rights. The most interesting fact that most pertains to this is in the 80s, the then Chicago mayor, Jane Byrne, who is a white woman, decided she will fix this, which I'm like, oh God, because we already had, like, if you take a step back, we already have, like, there was a housing project and, like, homes that Black families lived in that the city tore down to build Cabrini Green to start. So they're already not even really thinking about, like, all those displaced Black families and communities to even start with Cabrini Green. And then Cabrini Green was already becoming a failed project. And so the mayor decided that she would move in there to show people not to be afraid of this area, even though in the same breath, she'd be talking about the quote unquote gang banging that was happening at this place. So she decided to live there. So she lived there for only, I've seen some reports say 2, I've seen some say 3, but fair to say less than a month she lived in the housing project. And when she was there, the trash were picked up, elevators were fixed, they did rodent control, they repainted the building, which I note because there's a scene in Candyman where there's repainting happening, which I think is just like an interesting visual like callback. And people were happy because the project was starting to get actual attention. But then as soon as she left, everything went away. Like they stopped doing any upkeep to that facility, which sparked like activists to be like, hey, like CHA, Chicago, what are you doing?
Yeah. I want to jump in super quick. I made I fucked up. I did not live near Cabrini Green. I got my shit mixed up. It's in north. It's closer to the north side of Chicago and I was in the south side. I just wanted to correct my locations because my brain is not working. So no one is like, what the hell? Sorry, guys. Which is interesting where it was located in Chicago and where it is now. But we'll talk about that later. But yeah, anyway.
Across the highway?
So it's like it's kind of like in the loop. It's not in the loop, but it's in like, it's near what's called the Magnificent Mile, which is like, there's like Prada and like all these like really crazy big stores that you can go shopping in. And it's like the very nice, expensive part of Chicago, and that's where it's kind of near that part of Chicago where it's very white and very expensive to live.
Well, I mean, what happens after all of that? They said, you know what, we fucked up, I'm so sorry, and they decided to just demolish the Cabrini Green again. So like anyone living in those projects were displaced again. And so I just bring this up just because then what they decide to do is like, we'll make it better. But their version of making it better is just urban redevelopment, which is just a code word for gentrification. Because every time you hear that, it almost always means we're rebuilding high rise. We're going to rebuild it, so it'll be nicer. But the people that we just displaced can't afford to move into this new high rise building, which is actually why I think Nita Costa's film deserves a lot more credit. It is really important that Anthony, someone from Cabrini Green, lives in a high rise apartment in Chicago in an area that was quote unquote built up while people were pushed out. And that's where he starts his story, just to show how like he can't escape the cyclical violence and displacement of gentrification in his life. That for another time, but I just think it's really important to bring it in the context of the film. So I'll take a pause there because that was kind of a lot.
I mean, it's all just like you said, it's all just from my experience. Like it is, so everything you said is just, it's so fucked up. And it's the history of these cities. And again, with all of the context you gave, it's just so wild that Rose wanted to be like, I'm not saying anything political, but this is what happens when you take real world locations with these really complicated stories, that they're complicated because the Chicago politics are complicated, and the way that people like the mayors in Chicago have treated Black communities and seeing Black communities as violent, and that conflation, like it happens in a lot of cities, but Chicago has like a particularly like all of the research you did, Cass, has like a particularly storied past with a lot of this stuff. And so it's just like, you can't, it's just wild to me that anyone, no matter the year, would think, yeah, This is a good place to put this and not make a political statement. You know, like, huh? Knock, knock. Like, what's going on?
Yeah. And there's like the potentials is what gets me too, is because like, even if it's a, I don't agree that we needed a film in a way, I don't think you need to have a film in this white lens unless we're showing how the, unless we're showing how and why that's an issue and Helen getting a reckoning, which I don't think she really does by the end of the film, which we'll get to in a bit. But I think there was such interesting potential because there's that moment when she's in her apartment building and she like figures out that she can do the mirror thing, right? Where she can push out her bathroom mirror and look into the apartment next door. And she's looking at the newspaper clippings between the different, between the high rise she lives in now and the Cabrini Green project. And she's like, wow, they almost look the same. And it's like, well, at the end of the day, they really are the same. It's just one section of Chicago, like the landlords do their jobs, the city keeps it nice and pretty, and the tenants are happy and they make more money. And the other part, like with the same foundational building, isn't being taken care of. And you see how vastly, like they're vastly different ecosystems. But at the end of the day, like it's, you had the same potential to be in those spots. And I think like all those, like he was almost like he had to know what he was doing, having all those parallel shots. And, but like at the end, I love when like Helen like goes back to her apartment after like she gets committed and her like dumb husband's like girlfriend or whatever is painting the walls and like they're moving the furniture and they're already like essentially rebuilding a home, but a home without her. And she feels a kind of displacement. It's not quite the same, but she feels that that sensation of like being left behind and being like ostracized. And she's so broken by that. And you're like, okay, well, that's like a tenth of what like these entire communities have been facing for a very long time. And we could have done something with that too, but we just don't. And that just pisses me off so much because it could have been so much more interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of visual language in this that you're right. I feel it's there. And I think people that are looking for it will see it. But I don't think the film does enough to tie it all together, because that could be an interesting examination of the way in which we bury over the minority, the people that we think that society is, and I'm using this in quotes, less than. And so when she becomes this mentally unfit in their perspective person, it's like, oh, we just gonna paint over it and just forget that she ever exists. And so there is something very interesting there that, you're right, the film does not explore it. I think that's one of the frustrations. And you can see that this was written by a white man that probably doesn't understand all of the intricacies. Oh my God, I can't even say that word. It is morning.
It is morning.
of the subject matter.
And something that also frustrates me is like, and I don't know if that it's, you know, thinking about just how audiences react to race, any kind of like discussion of race and horror now, it's like, was it willful ignorance? So he would think he wasn't alienating people. Like, and again, in 1992, I'm not sure what, like the whole, like what the film scene was really like. We all know it was not great in terms of race and the stereotypes that existed in horror. So like, is this also, could it also, and again, this is 100% conjecture. I have no notes to really like say this, but you know, I always wonder how much does marketing go into these things too, which is like a bummer, but
it's true.
Were they thinking about, oh, well, people won't like it if it's marketed, if it's this way? You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. And I'd always, that always bothers me too, and how people think about marketing and having that be such an important part of if the story is going to have more mass appeal. And that I think is also why I loved Nia DaCosta's Candyman and how it was so unapologetically not for universal audiences necessarily, and had a point, a much more confident and strong like perspective on what it was talking about. I think this movie just wanted to be scary, and I think it doesn't have as much of a perspective really as it should, and that is very frustrating.
Yeah, like one question I had for this is, and it's something that Gross has talked about before, where he's like, well, you can also like look at this film as if Helen did do it, and I never like do it in the sense that like this entire time we're watching this white woman lose a grip on her sanity and murder or injure, or try to destroy all these black people's lives. And I actually don't think the film is saying that based on how it chooses to end it. But I will say that I had a beat last night where I was like, I kind of see how this could be happening, especially with the bloody wall saying it was always you, Helen, left by Candyman. I was just like, it was always you fucking white woman. But I wanted it, that to be it, because I wanted it to be like, oh yeah, you have to realize that, like, you are the problem, Helen. Like, you're coming in and being like Mayor Byrne, being like, I'm going to solve this, like, this idea and this problem just because I can do this as this one white woman. And then I realized everything's complicated and messy. And now, like, I'm all conflicted and it's hard. And I really just wanted her to, like, I don't know, actually realize she was a villain. But did anyone else ever hear that read or see that read in the film? Or were you always like, no, this is very clearly always like Candyman is a villain. Helen is just being manipulated, arguably victimized, and it's messy. Like, did anyone else like see that reading?
They talked about it on the commentary track, and I just didn't find it very persuasive. I think there's like a point in the movie, which is like 45 minutes to an hour in, where you actually see Candyman. And after that point, it's like very difficult, even if we're in Helen's perspective, especially like the psychologist that he murders from behind disembowels him. Like, Helen didn't kill that guy from behind. Like, she was in front of him. And maybe we're in her point of view and she's like imagining, like disassociating and imagining herself in the chair as she kills the guy from behind. But why isn't he turning around then?
I don't think they did the full work to do that. I think they could have had it. I think, but then I think they wanted to introduce, again, it feels like they could have gone that route, but they wanted to make like a cool villain, a horror villain. And look, Candyman fucking rules. And I know we can talk more about like Candyman's origin and how it is very much rooted in Black trauma, Black artist trauma, which again, I think Nia DaCosta's Candyman really, really hits home with, is like the inheritance of Black trauma and what the effects are of using that like for your figures. But I think they did create a really cool horror, and again, a Black horror villain is amazing. Like, we don't have a lot of those in horror, and I think Tony Todd is incredible. So I don't disparage them for creating him, but like, own it. Don't try to be like, he was a figment. Like, plenty of movies do that and they like make it clear. They make it look like he is the monster and she is safe, and then she's the white savior at the end. So like,
literally, yeesh,
like she's a white savior at the end of this movie. So like, it just, I don't know. I don't buy it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't buy it.
No, but also, you know, I mean, none of us are Black. And so I did want to go take a look at what I could find out there. And there were two articles, one written by Evan Narcisse. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce his last name, but he is, he's a journalist and a comic book writer. And I think he's a narrative designer too. And he wrote an article for Rolling Stone back in 2018 about the original Candyman. And he ends it with an interesting statement about, and it kind of ties into what we've been talking about, where he says, quote, Helen and Candyman are the demonic answers to the unspoken question rumbling inside the movie. What happens when people only want to believe the worst about you? He tells Helen, our names will be written on a thousand walls, our crimes told and retold by our faithful believers. In a political climate where fear and stereotypes, this was written in 2018, by the way, in a political climate where fear and stereotypes are tearing America's psyche to shreds, Candyman is scarier than ever because it reveals how deftly we can damn each other. That's genuinely terrifying, no matter how many times you say it into a mirror.
Great closing.
And I think that's an interesting read on it.
The other journalist you found say.
So this other one was written for The Root by Lawrence Ware. And one of the funny-ish things that he says is, put simply, this is the ultimate, quote, leave those white girls alone movie. His infatuation with white women and his desire to enter white society make him who he is. And Helen, the main character of the film, is the new object of his desire. This was written and directed by a white man, but I am convinced that my grandmother, whose only advice for me when I left college was work hard and leave them damn white girls alone, was a consultant on the film.
Oh, I love that.
I love that.
And yeah. He says that Candyman remains a phenomenological, I don't even phenomenological.
Phenomenological.
Examination of historical trauma, and still one of the most horrifying films I've ever seen. Yet as an adult, I now see that the character played by Tony Todd is not the real villain of the film. It is now clear to me that, as in Get Out, whiteness is the thing lurking in the darkness of which we should all be afraid.
Yeah, I love that read too, because like they talk about in the film with like how like the Candyman guy becomes Candyman. He was the son of a formerly incarcerated slave, and then they were able to like move up in society. And that's like half the reason why he has, like, when we see him with like a fur coat, like on him as like a symbol of like bourgeois like sensibilities, and the idea that he went to like the quote unquote good schools, like in the Chicago area, and like in a lot of ways, like chasing prosperity and success, but also like proximity to whiteness is implied, especially with the idea that he was spending a lot of time with like a white love and how that damned him quite literally. So like, I feel like that's like also that part of the urban legend, I think, is like what that last, although really funny, like quote is really digging into, is just the like, yes, white, leave those white ladies alone. But that idea, don't lose yourself in whiteness, and that them, I don't know, I'm not black. And I'm but I think that's like a really strong point that is in the story that's drenched quite literally in whiteness, but it's in there. And like, God, when you hear the story about like what happened to like Candyman before he became the villain, that they like put bees in him, like it's just so horrible. Yeah, and it's just like, it feels like an urban legend of a version of lynching, but they couldn't put lynching in a film like this. So we hear this even more graphic
tale. They made it even worse. You know what I mean? Like, they cut off his hand, they shoved a hook in it, which is why, like, I sometimes wish this movie was more of a revenge movie for Candyman. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I think there's definitely a reading for this to go into like revenge against whiteness and this whole thing that I am not fully, like, I haven't fully fleshed out that thought in my head. But I think there is something really interesting about like him getting revenge and like thinking of him as a vengeful figure. But again, this movie is focused on Helen, so it's a little bit harder, but like it's harder to have that perspective. But to me, I think there is an interpretation or something in there. And I haven't watched 2 or 3, the Candyman 2 or 3, by the way. I don't know if it goes into that at all, but I know that he's still infatuated with white women in the rest of those movies until Nia DaCosta's Candyman, where it's like, why are we doing this? Thank you, Nia DaCosta. Please, everyone, keep giving this woman work.
Yeah. And so I did want to also include, so Lawrence, who was writing on At the Root, also talks about one of this is a section that I thought was really interesting too, where he's talking about when the movie goes to the housing projects, the filmmakers shoot the spaces of Black people who populate it are monstrous. Mm-hmm. He says the residents of the housing project are lifeless and haunted. The set design is deviant, and the music is ominous. It treats Black bodies as if they're a menace to the civility of white society. And while that deeply disturbed me, I found it comical how Helen, emboldened by sheer white audacity, could not be convinced that seeking out Candyman was a bad idea. She set in motion all that came after, yet the film consistently depicts her as though she is someone with whom we should be sympathetic or empathetic with. It felt very much like a sad story of a white woman who voted for Donald Trump and thereafter lamented her choice. Except I don't give a damn about white regret over actions that create Black pain. In that way, this film feels both prophetic and derivative, even 25 years after it premiered.
I think that's because I remember when we were rewatching last night, we had that moment when like she first kind of pulls up to Cabrini Green, like her and Bernadette, and they come out and like, just like you say, right, there's that kind of like ominous staging of like the scary Black men who are watching them. But like, as we kind of watch it, we're like, wait a second, like all of their questions are very valid. They're just like, who are you? What are you doing here? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't belong here. Like, what are you just walking in here? Like, what do you want?
Yeah.
We're like, wait a second.
And also, like, as part of the Nia DaCosta's like official companion guide to 2021's Candyman, within it, there's a lot of like interviews and people that like grew up in Cabrini Green and in that area. And one of the, my favorite quotes that I got from it, I'm definitely paraphrasing here, is just like the idea that everyone you like, you love and know lives in like a 4-block radius when you're living in the projects, like your mom, your aunt, your the people you go to school with, like the convenience store you go to, like your person you work with, like your girlfriend, like everyone is in like a 4x4 radius. So like, you know, quite literally like your people, your community, because everyone is like everyone is operating the same space because of like housing constraints and economic constraints, et cetera, that it would be the most reasonable thing in the world if someone walked into like your very tight knit community and you're like, who are you? And not only doesn't like introduce themselves, like shudders as she walks by you and ignores you. And it's like your house. Like, what is she doing?
It's just like the most white woman thing of like walking around and feeling entitled to a space that is, and like the confidence of walking into a space that is not yours. And like being like, well, it's public space, but it's like, but you would do the same, like, what the fuck? Like, this is not your space, though. This is a community space. And I think that's what a lot of people in general forget when they go into these space, like in any kind of space that is meant for a community, and you go in and you're not recognized, it's going to be like, what are you doing here? When you walk in with that confidence and that kind of like disdain or fear of them, they're like, we know you're scared of us, we're not going to treat you properly, like you're looking at us like we are objects on a piece of paper for you to study, like we're not people that live, breathe, have to like deal with all, everything here.
And it really demonizes, and I love that that Terry brought in that quote too, because I think you're right, I think this set design demonizes the projects when it's like, like I, like back in high school, like I used to work at Boston Market, and a part of, I don't know if they still do it, I thought it was pretty rad when they did it then, although I was very confused at the time because I was like a 15-year-old, 16-year-old, but they had as part of the, their hiring process, they had to hire like X percentage amount of like formerly incarcerated people to like work there at all times. I think it's because they get some sort of tax write-off. But at the end of the day, like I do actually think it's more people should do that. But two of the people I used to work with lived in housing projects in Providence. And so like I would drive them to their house. And I remember like the first time I did, because of like growing up in the 90s, the idea of like, oh, like the quite literally ghettoization of that area was something that like it was instilled in our brains. I remember at first being like, honestly scared, because I was like, this is not some place I'm next to or near. I don't have knowledge of this. Everything I've seen in movies and TVs is just like horrible, like demonization of it. And I think this movie does that. But it's just a place where people live. And it's a place where people, I remember I got my first lesson of not riding someone's bumper when I was driving them back to back home multiple times, because they're just like, you can't do that, Cass. Like if you're riding their bumper, they're gonna be like, what the fuck do you want with me? Like, are you trying to like, are you literally like a cop? Like, are you tailing me for something? Are you trying to start shit? And I was like, oh, I do not want to start shit. But like, it was a great lesson of just like, mind your space, mind your distance. And I just, I can't say that enough, because I feel like obviously this was me talking about my 15, 16 year old brain. But I also think that like, we get these ideas and images from movies like this when it's mostly more like Anne Marie and thank God Anne Marie's in 1992's Candyman. It's mostly just like Anne Marie, just like, I'm trying to feed my baby and go to work. Who the fuck are you in my living room? What do you want? Like, why did you just enter my apartment?
Some interesting things they said during the commentary track, they were definitely intentionally exploiting Black men as images of horror. Like they're intentionally using that stereotype. They also shot the exteriors at the real Cabrini Green, as well as the stairwell scenes.
I don't know. That makes me feel, I don't know about all that. I mean, like, cool that you're integrating it, but also like,
did you pay anyone there?
Fuck real. Like, did you pick anyone out?
I'm guessing everybody.
Yeah.
I think it goes back to that. This has always stuck with me when we went to that Faculty of Horror panel and they brought up that point of like, is this depicting or subverting, right? Like, just because you're depicting doesn't mean that you're actually making an interesting commentary or trying to subvert it. Like, you may be aware of it and you may be demonstrating your awareness, but are you doing anything more than that? And I think that that might be the hang up in this case.
Yeah, because also like, Philip Glass could have written a different score.
No,
like,
he couldn't.
Like the lighting of those scenes in Cabrini Green on the exteriors could have been different. Like they were shot in a very like colorless way, like very like gray setting and just like gritty. Like they know what they were doing, I think. And I think that's just what Ryan says just make me think of that even more. I do want to shout out just Bernadette, because I feel like she is an interesting I know. I know. I hate that she gets fucking killed, but I do love, because I often feel like, and especially movies written and directed by white men and at all tackling racism, that like we just don't talk about colorism at all. And I was definitely on board for Bernadette being like a light-skinned Black woman, like is like a university like professor of some sort. Like she clearly has money, she's wearing a bunch of jewelry and like has a nice car and like acts a kind of way towards being around the housing projects at all. And I think I'm like, yeah, this is interesting. Like, I wish her and Anne-Marie got to talk more than 5 seconds, but like, I like the way she even talks about like, and the way she gets like huffed up about it. Like, I'm like, this is interesting because it's complicated and it's messy, but so is like colorism, so is race, but we don't do much with her. And she's just ends up becoming Helen's sidekick and then dies by Candyman / Helen's hands. But I do just want to shout out Cassie Lemons, but I think like, she's such an intriguing character.
It's so fascinating in Anne Marie's like apartment when like she's kind of like coming down and she like looks at the two of them and is just like, I'm sorry to give you all a hard time when white folks come in and ask us these questions. And like Bernadette just kind of like looks at the floor.
I love Tony Todd as the Candyman. I'm not saying that this movie shouldn't exist. I'm just saying it's just when we're analyzing it from that like urban legend point of view and the context of Cabrini Green and who Helen's character is. And then we have the one black woman to like be her foil and she dies. It's just like, really? God damn it. Like you again, like just not thinking about these, what like the optics of these things, you know, it's just very 1992 white guy. It was almost, it felt like almost like she was shoehorned in there as like a don't go there kind of like BFF. And then she's just kind of like slaughtered. And it's so annoying because Cassie Lemons is an incredible actor and like filmmaker. So it's just like another one of those situations where it was like
piggyback on and add that like, not just like murdered, at no fault of her own. It wasn't like she was exploring the noise stupidly in the other room or something. Yep. It was like she visited her sick friend and just got fucking killed.
Well, my last thought before, if anyone has any other final thoughts on Candyman, is I can't not sing Tony Todd. I feel like it's important just to acknowledge all the other things in the movie if we talk about it, but like Tony Todd's phenomenalist. He's an incredible actor. He has the most like one of the most commanding on-screen presence like I've ever seen in film and in horror film especially. I just think that he's wonderful and wanted to shout that out.
He really is.
Did anyone have anything else to say about Candyman before we moved on?
R.I.P. I mean, Maria's doggy, who is such a good boy. He's a protector. He's such a good
boy. But yeah, I love Candyman. I mean, again, it had, like we talked about, there's so many issues with the context, but again, like I'm so glad at least we have Tony Todd as an iconic horror villain who really just like sells it, and we also have Nia DaCosta as Candyman, so like, you know, good things all around. And I know I think what always frustrates me is like people get frustrated when we have these conversations like you're trying to cancel Candyman. It's like, no, we're trying to better understand Candyman so we can appreciate it and also be able to understand like maybe why it's not always the best movie to be talking about, like with like in terms of et cetera, et cetera. Words.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like I still really like watching this movie. I still have a lot of fun with it.
Oh, same.
And it's like I feel like the point is to always have these conversations, and we can like something and be like, this could have been better. And when we make like future films starring black characters, they deserve better. And the only way we learn that is through like looking back at what was done and talking about it. So like, fuck off, people that say I can't like a movie and criticize it.
What a great score by Philip Glass, though.
Oh yeah. I think it's really interesting that the original ending was based on Guy Fawkes Day, which is like a huge deal in England where they burn all of this stuff. And because it was produced by Clive Barker and written by Bernard Rose, two Englishmen, they like kept this Guy Fawkes Day tradition in this American movie. And it doesn't really make sense that they had this giant bonfire.
I had no fucking idea why that was happening this week. I was like, is it because no one came to pick up the trash and they just said fuck it and burned everything?
My read was that like this was just a pile of, you know, just junk because there's constant turnover in the like housing projects there, and like there's no trash cleanup, like there's nothing to do when somebody like dies or leaves an apartment but just shove off all of the stuff. And it just gathers together and gathers together. And I got the sense that this whole like fire pyre thing was like organized by like the Candyman Whisperer kids, like, because it's those kids who like do it and like come down and like they seem to have some sort of attachment or awareness. And they like deliberately talk about like, we found Candyman. He's like hanging out, it like trying to find shelter in this place. We're going to burn him out. So it's not like it was like a ritual. Like bonfire, it was a like, oh, we're gonna literally smoke this guy out and like finally get him. At least that's the way that the film tries to logically
explain. I kind of got that too,
but it's in there because it's a Guy Fawkes Day thing and they have to explain it because there's no Guy Fawkes Day in the US,
but we do love a good bonfire.
Our second breakout movie is Butterfly Kisses. It's a found footage horror film with a triple frame device, which is pretty nifty. Sophia, played by Rachel Armiger, is a college student working on a thesis documentary with Feldman, played by Reed Delisle. The two are investigating the urban legend of Peeping Tom. And his story is that if you stare at the end of a tunnel for an hour, he'll come after you, and getting closer each time you blink. And so you get to the point where his eyelashes are tickling your eyelashes. The butterfly kisses. They can't stare for an hour. They decide to use a camera, which does not blink, to summon the spirit. Filmmaker Gavin York, played by Seth Adam Kalick, is given the footage by his in-laws, and they find it in their basement. And he attempts to edit into a film, while documentary filmmaker the late Eric Christoph Myers, who's played by the fictional film's writer director himself, this is his last film, unfortunately, records the events. So that's our triple frame. We have a documentary about a documentary about a documentary. So my first question: how long can y'all go without blinking?
Oh, I'm not long.
Not an hour.
I'd be screwed. I wouldn't. Well, I wouldn't even be able to do it. I'd be like,
this is such a like perfect sort of like fake urban legend because it like hits all those points because. It like you literally can't do it, right? Like they have the eye doctor in at that one point who's just like, haha, doesn't seem reasonable at all. Please don't try it. You just can't do it. But like it makes you want to try. Like it's almost plausible enough. It's like maybe. So like, yeah, I think that's like a perfect sort of like it could be plausible, but it definitely isn't. That's why it's like a story urban legend.
Yeah, what were everyone's initial reactions? I think we mostly liked it.
I really liked it. Yeah, I felt like it reminded me, we'll get to it, reminded me a lot about some real life like implications of things like creepypasta and urban legends. And I liked that it felt real because it reminded me of like real life cases. And to the extent mm-hmm. that when I finished watching it with Chris, I was like, I kind of like really want to believe that Peeping Tom is real in the context of this film. And Chris is like, no, this is clearly just a hoax. That's the whole point.
Very much in the hoax. And I was like, reading a bit.
I want it to be real in the context of the film. And I like that it inspired that belief. And that's really hard to do, which I think goes back to what Chris was saying about like there has to be some sort of aspect of the belief. And the fact that I wanted to believe in it shows that it was successful for sure.
Well, isn't it not based on a real thing? Because no. There's an article in 2016 about Peeping Tom, and but that's before this movie came out.
I can tell you about that. Actually, I do know about this. I don't want to spoil it too much because I don't know.
Go ahead, Cass.
Ryan has prepared. But so the filmmaker Myers, a year before he started filming, he wrote a bunch of different articles in different like.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I found it. Yeah, this is so cool for a year. And because he did an interview in any like I can source it in the show notes where he's like, yeah. So for a year before, he basically wrote a bunch of different articles, posted on Reddit under different like names, and it got to the point where enough things were published that it made its way onto like I forget the name of the city that it's based in, but the tourism of that city's website to be like, oh, the local legend of Peeping Tom. And he did it all to the extent so that when he got to actually making it, people would be like, oh yeah, that legend, Peeping Tom.
It's hoax inception, y'all. It's a hoax with
what the hell.
That is a very long con. I love it.
Wow.
Isn't that wild? Like, goddamn, Myers, what a talent. That's such commitment to it.
Did he mention at any point why he picked the name Peeping Tom?
No, not in the interviews I found.
How'd that name work for y'all?
So, I mean, like, it always makes me think of, like, Peeping Toms, like, creepy dudes who watch you. So it is so funny to me that is the name, and then it is so much more horrifying than that. It's just, like, they use the, because I feel like Peeping Toms, people have like stories about like, oh, a creepy guy was like in my window. And it takes that urban, that urban legend of the creepy guy and just makes it even more fucking creepy. And I kind of love that it's playing with what you think a Peeping Tom is and taking it to like the worst possible level of his little eyelashes just on your face, which is absolutely fucking repulsive. I hate it so much. So I recommended this movie because I'm shocking everybody once again, found footage crazy over here, Mary Beth McAndrews. And this is a very underseen found footage movie. I think it's so smart in how it creates truth. I think I love when found footage movies layer media. It's not just one tape you found. It's someone found the tape and is making a documentary about them finding that tape. And there's someone else making a document. And this gets into that in a really fun, fascinating way that plays with what happens when you buy into an urban legend. Mm-hmm. And I think it really and we mentioned creepypasta, so I'm gonna just briefly mention it. Sorry, Ryan, if I'm like taking over really quick from what you're. I'm so sorry. You just got me on my excited horse. But this really is like such an interesting example of like a story that had a lot of legs, and then someone made a documentary about it that was found by another guy. And he's like, I've heard of this, and we have to learn more about it. And then using the camera to summon him is such a smart way of using technology of like, and I love when urban legends meet technology / like cryptids, because it's like, okay, we've had these around before we had the internet, before we had cameras, before we had this. So how the fuck do we capture it now if it's real? And I think it is so cool to be like, the camera is an eye and doesn't blink. And you're like, oh no, shit, that's such a good idea. But don't do that, because like, that's such a bad fucking idea. And I love how this movie plays with how you can use technology to capture urban legendary and to like expand the idea of what an urban legend of a folktale is. And it's just like, I think it's so smart in what it's doing. And also really fucking scary. Like the imagery in this is terrifying. I think they really hit a really interesting balance of stuff here.
Yeah. The more and more you think about the implication of who is viewing who, like the
yes.
of like, the sounds are made up. I guess I'm making up the digital eye of the film, because there's like the eye of like the camera, right? But then there's like the lenses we're watching it through. Because like at one point the characters realize that even if the camera goes on and off, like what happens when you're watching the images from that camera on another screen? Like that's a different kind of lens, right? Like, aren't we still kind of looking through this other lens? And just like how little control we have once things start to like
grow. It's like the ring effect though. You know what I mean? It's like that viral spreading of something that you've heard about. And like, I think The Ring is such a good example to kind of talk about with Butterfly Kisses, of like that tape, that thing you saw. So what does that mean when you watch it? And then again, like with the camera capturing Peeping Tom, it's like, oh shit. So now you can spread it. Like this is a new way to spread the virus of fear, basically, which I think creepypastas do a really good job of. Like Slender Man was not a figure. And really until the internet. And I've done a lot of research about like him as a folkloric figure, which is for another podcast. But like, it's just really interesting how this film doesn't fully go into that creepypasta realm, but like it's playing in that space in a really cool way. And this was filmed in Maryland near where I live. I think it was actually filmed. Hold on. Is it filmed where I got married? I have to figure out if it was filmed where I got married.
Did you get married in that tunnel?
Yeah. I did not get married in that tunnel, but it looks like the town where I got married. All of that area around there looks very similar, but it's another Maryland production. So I didn't know that until after I watched
Ellicott
it.
City.
Yeah, Ellicott City. That's where I got. That's Terry. You were there.
I was
Terry,
like,
you were
I was
there
thinking,
at my wedding.
Yes,
in Ellicott. Like, it's Ellicott, not Ellicott. It's Ellicott.
Okay. My bad.
It's Elliot. Ellicott City, Maryland is where I thought so. I got married there.
But in
Halloween
the fake article
year.
I found, apparently, about this fake ghost thing, it talks about Ellicott City. And so I was like, wait, I'm pretty sure that's where it is.
I did go down a rabbit hole when I first saw this. And I was like, wait, is that real? Because Ellicott City is haunted. Like, it's like old. It's like, it is like cobblestone street. Old, like, it's been flooded a bunch of times. It's like crazy. But it's old, old Maryland. So it's like ghost Maryland. So I was like, of course there's a freaky man in a tunnel with a top hat. But, like, I just kind of bought it because I was like, of course he's here. Why wouldn't he be?
Yeah.
But what I'm hearing, Mary Beth, is that we need to go find this Ilchester tunnel. And
look, I'll show you. Let me fucking tell you real quick, that tangent. Ellicott City has so there's a ton of like urban legends in Ellicott City of all these old convent, like old convents and churches that have fallen apart in the woods. And I've gone hiking in those woods and found a bunch of those old ruins everywhere. And it's a very Catholic, like Catholic city. So yeah, next time you come visit, Terry, I'll take you to all the scary spots in the woods that I've taken photos of.
Will you guys do the 1 hour no blink challenge next time he visits?
No, he will. He'll do it. He'll do it. I'll leave him alone.
I will be able to
do
it though. An hour?
We'll buy a cheap camera and do it with the cheap camera and see what happens.
I love this idea. Why don't we stream it live and then
this is how we cause the next pulse, is we spread a
horrible digital virus of ghosts through the internet, and this don't like it. I don't want to be responsible with it.
It's like if you hit refresh while it's streaming for an hour, does that break that's it? Does that is that a blink?
Isn't that a blink?
That's a blink.
I think that's a blink. What happens if your internet stops working and you don't refresh? But like, what is that?
That must be a blink too, right? Because blinks aren't voluntary. I think that has to be a blink.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that it's interesting thinking of, because definitely I have a certain take on the movie is probably not the same as everybody, but like,
I want to hear it.
What isn't being spread isn't Peeping Tom. Like, what's being spread is the like weird obsession of Peeping Tom, and to like take ownership of it and to make it your story instead of the shared collective thing. And that's what kind of creates this like self-destructive spiral for all three of the views that we see. And we see in each case they're all falling into levels of like hoaxing to make it happen and to sell the story and to like commodify the story, and that like wrecks them in various different ways, especially with Gavin, right? And so like I always find the way that their story is framed as so different from some of the communal experiences that we see on the sidelines. Like my favorite scene is when they're just like interviewing people on the street who are like talking about Peeping Tom, and especially when they like see the teens, and like you hear like news reports of like, oh, teens love to go out and like try to see Peeping Tom, but like very clearly they're not going to these like insane lengths to literally like find ways around to do it. They're doing it because they're bored teenagers that want a reason to hang out, and so like one will like try to keep his eyes open for like maybe a minute, and then we'll like fail. And then all of his friends are like, ah, dude, you couldn't do it. Like, that's the point of urban legends. Like you share it, you like have your scares, you play around, like maybe you try to hunt to see whether it's real, but you never go to these lengths to not only prove that it's real, but to prove that it's real so that you can make it your story and sell a movie or like get a good grade in this class.
It's the Blair Witch Project effect though, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like taking the urban legend, being like, I'm gonna prove it's real or not, and then being like, I shouldn't have done that.
That's what happened to Helen too.
That's very true.
Yeah.
Because it's not a creepypasta, but it reminds me of the way in which creepypasta stories will mutate, because it's a story that someone has created, and then all of a sudden people are taking it, making it their own, and creating a story that is an offshoot from that. And so I was really impressed with the structure of this being sort of like a movie within a movie within a movie, and the way in which each person is interacting with the source material and trying to change it to fit their needs and tell a story for another viewer. And so I thought there was an interesting correlation there between the way in which creepypastas can mutate and the way in which the story here is being mutated, or by the one by Gavin cutting out specific things, and he's getting interrogated by his documentarian. It's like, well, you cut out these scenes. And so it's like this idea of we're trying to sell a specific story versus exploring what the real story is in interesting ways. I liked it a lot with that.
Yeah, it definitely felt more to me like it was about the obsession rather than the urban legend itself. Like the obsession and the slow deterioration of the filmmaking ethics as we went, I really, really liked.
Yeah, can I read you like the 7 tenets that Myers made for himself of like how to make Peeping Tom?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So, please. And I love it too, because when we were talking about it, I was just like, check. Like, so like making him proud. So the thing that like Mary Beth is already saying about like the location was so key and was like a paranormal location. Like the first thing in his list was the location had to have a pre-existing reputation for the paranormal, but no one specific legend. Like it had to be a place that had like multiple like things surrounding it. He wanted to make sure that the tunnel which he picked didn't have its own urban legend already attached to that location. So that was a big factor, but it felt like it could. The newly created story had to be reported prior to the film's release. This was accomplished by seeding the internet with articles written under a variety of pseudonyms to establish the historical aspect. And he was saying he began a year prior to filming, which we talked about already. And that, yes, you can find on Ellicott City Tourism's website, the Peeping Tom as like a note there. I hope it's still there. I'm not sure. We'll have to look. The entity needed to be the focal point of the grisly story, but not necessarily the specific plot of it. But everyone had to be interested in the entity. The entity have had differing names. So in the film, you hear him called Peeping Tom, Blink Man, Ilchester the Molester, Winky, Tunnel Guy. The means by which Peeping Tom had to be summoned had to be evocative of other popular legends like Bloody Mary. So that's where he created the blinking rule. The film required an appearance by a folklorist or authority on 14 topics. So Matt Lake, who is in the movie, is actually known for being famous in Maryland and in Pennsylvania for his books on mythology and whatnot, and things that are just weird. So they wanted to make sure Matt Lake was in the movie, so it would also make audiences question, like, am I actually watching like a documentary, or is this like a Blair Witch Project situation here? Of course, the film needed to have an iconic image of the entity that was questionable, in the same way that the Loch Ness Monster is questionable, where like the quality is just good enough to seem valid, but just off enough that it can't quite be proven. And it had to exist in that murky ground so that either sides, the skeptics and the believers, could argue with it. I just think those are such great tenets for making an urban legend film.
Absolutely.
There's so much more care given to it that I feel like than a lot of urban legend horror films have. I feel like people take them like, oh, people know it, whatever. But he like he didn't just make an urban legend film. He created an urban legend and then made a film around it, which I think is so, it's like that extra mile of like you creating your own urban legend, which also speaks to like how gullible we all are. And like, I'll fucking admit it, I'll buy that shit hook, line, and sinker. I love that stuff. I love, like, and I've talked about this a million times, like, even if I don't fully believe it, I love it. I'll be like, oh, hell yeah. Like, I love knowing all that stuff. And like, I know how these stories pop up. So I just love how he exploited that in such an interesting way to make this movie. And that's why I think, again, this movie deserves so much more attention for what it's doing and what it tried to do.
Because I think that what Gavin's doing is like the reverse of that.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And that, like, interesting, because like any time that he's confronted with anybody who like loves stories or like is into the paranormal, he constantly just gets roasted. They're just like, dude, come on, like, what are you talking about? Like, I really
that
love
paranormal conference
faith communities.
Yes
Oh, the yes
was so funny to me, where he's basically like laughed out literally laughed out the room. I love that scene. I just loved it.
Those aunties were like, not today, Gavin. And it's just like,
we're here for actual ghosts, you stupid asshole. Like, don't make fun of us. And he's like, oh my God.
Yeah, between that and they're like, how much money are you going to give this project? You know? And he's like, I could maybe, you know, scrounge up like $2,000 for this film. And I was like, ah. And the, oh, a fun fact about Gavin is like, again, Myers going above and beyond. When they were filming it, the actor that plays Gavin, Seth Adam Kalick. So on Seth Adam Kalick's Facebook page, he was taking photographs and documenting the things that he was doing as he was like entering his character for Gavin. So he was like taking photos of like the do not like open box of tapes that are supposedly were the Peeping Tom videotapes, and like saying that he was like going to this tunnel one day and like leaving little timestamps so that like it could just, again, if you watch this film without any other context, but you knew people like Matt Lake, you knew that the director that's in this movie is actually a real life director. There's enough plausible believability that you're like, wait, maybe parts of this are real that got fictionalized. I just think that's really interesting.
It also makes, I think the commentary on Blair Witch itself is really kind of funny in this, when you have Ed Sanchez calling in, and he makes a comment about how he's upset that Gavin is basically trying to sell this as a real life movie as a marketing. And it's a very funny moment, because I was one of the people that went into Blair Witch thinking it was a real thing that was shot, because of all of the marketing behind it as being a real thing. And so I thought that was very, very smart and very funny, as sort of like Ed kind of making a commentary about it as well, but also kind of poking fun at himself in a way, because they did the same thing.
Do you want, so some funny little trivia. I know two of the guys who produced this movie, and so like they're all friends with Ed, and they shot, and Ed Sanchez lives in Frederick near me, and I've worked with him before. So it's just like this, it's like really interesting regional filmmaking in Maryland, where like they're all hanging out and like making found footage movies together, and they just all know each other. And I love that they were able to use Ed to like that advantage. I just find it very funny.
Very impressed with Ed's performance, as well as Matt Lake's performance, especially Matt Lake is not an actor. He writes the Weird Maryland books.
I'm in the Weird Maryland book.
Are you?
I have, yes. I have, yes. So, okay, this is like my baby's first writing thing. I submitted to Weird Maryland when I was in middle school because I went to this haunted Girl Scout camp, and they have a whole page of two of the stories I wrote in Weird Maryland from a long time ago. So
that's awesome.
Not stories, but like they're based on real things, but it was cool. So I have two things in Weird Maryland, at least like if it's still the same thing. I wrote it when I was in like middle school and never thought anything would happen. So it's kind of neato.
That's very neat. I feel like we're now even more connected to Peeping Tom.
Yeah. But like, Maryland is a weird place. It has a lot of that like urban legend shit because it's just a weird state. But I think that's what I love about this film is how they play with the format of the tape to see our image. Like when we are seeing him appear, like when they're rewinding and like fast forwarding and rewinding and they're getting close, zooming in. I love when found footage like plays with this and really gets into the format of the tapes, of like the pixelization and like what the form looks like even at the end of the tunnel. And I think it's so fucking scary the way that they're able to include that kind of technological thing in this to show him appearing and getting closer. And it just makes it, again, it makes it feel more real. Like, oh my God, he's in the film. You can see him appearing. It doesn't seem like special effects. Like something about that, while we know it's special effects, the way it's framed makes it feel real in that moment. At least like it tricks you. And I love the way they're able to really trick you. Like, oh no, we're going to zoom in on the tape, on the footage, and we're gonna let you really fucking see it. Like this isn't some like that Patterson Gimlin Bigfoot footage of like not being able to really look at it. Like you can really see the moment he appears, and it's just so chilling and so effective in conveying that horror.
Yeah, I think the repeated viewings of that image also add to just the underlying creep factor, because you see it again and again and again. And then in reverse at the very end, and it's all so creepy.
It's like when they're like, where's Waldoing? But like for their lives, when they're trying to find him in the footage, and then like at the restaurant and they see him across the street. And I'm like, oh no. Like when that started happening, I was like, oh no, this is a nightmare. But again, it's that you can capture him on footage, but capturing him on footage is not going to help you. Like you might think, I feel like in found footage, there's always that idea of like, oh, if you get it on camera, there's something validating and something like about that might save you. But then found footage also collapses that and being like, it doesn't matter if you got it on footage because it's still coming for you. And again, this movie really hammers that home of like, yeah, and that footage is being actually weaponized against you, baby. Sorry. And I love that.
I love the idea too, that it's like based on how the camera works, at least I think, like Peeping Tom is coming closer and closer to the lens of that camera. But like, I think the lens, like whether or not it's on or off, the camera allows you to see where Peeping Tom is. But when that camera is off, like he's still like coming for you and he's still following you. It's just you can't see him without that camera, which to me is the scariest part, is that he could be right next to you, but just because you can't see him doesn't mean he's not there. And that's like the ick that I got between that and the top hat. Like when he did the top hat thing, I don't know why. Like there's a feel. There's something about that that just like, I was like, ah! Like I was like, I get it. And there's some visual similarity to Slender Man sort of in the shape. I was like, oh, okay, it's not too scary. But then when he did the top hat, it was just, I don't know why. It really, really.
It's too much sentience. There's too much sentience and like too much personality. And that's when you know you're like, no, he's not just some mindless creature. Like he's really coming to fuck with me. That's not, and that sucks.
In the world of the film, do y'all believe the original student-led like video? Do y'all think that like Peeping Tom is real and captured, or do you think they made it all up?
Oh, I think it's real and captured. I fully went full. It's real. I think it's fully. To me, this feels like a cursed videotape type movie, and you're fucking with a cursed tape that you shouldn't have touched in the first place kind of vibe. That's how I view it.
Yeah, I think the end of Gavin suggests to me that Peeping Tom is real. We don't get to see Gavin's body, but it did not sound like they found a suicide. It sounded like they felt like a dismembered, fucked up body.
Yeah.
I'm still hardcore in the hoax camp. I think that the film
made it up.
I think that what the real curse of the film is not the curse of Peeping Tom. I think the curse is the curse of trying to make a cursed film and getting so like desperately involved in like making this movie that you destroy yourself. Because I do think that Gavin is dead. I do think that he killed himself, but I also think that he was hoaxing a lot of this material. The film students have a history of making things up. Gavin, we get plenty of clues of him deliberately leaving out really important information. Yeah, I like those clues and think they're very well seated. And I definitely follow them down the path of like, this is definitely hoax inception.
I like the idea that an idea is dangerous, you know, like that is, I think the scariest thing about urban legends is that like, kind of like, it's like Pontypool, which I've rewatched recently, which I love. It's just like, ideas are scary. And if you get a certain idea in your head and you can't get it out, like, what are you going to do? And that, like that obsession killed them all. But I believe in the hoax, but I like the alt read that like, it's just you, something can consume you. And then once you get to that level of obsession, like you can't really undo what's already been done kind of thing, which we kind of see in Candyman too. But I like the idea of believing the hoax.
She Dies Tomorrow also does that really well.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. That's a good one.
Yes.
One thing about Peeping Tom, I don't think the movie cares whether you believe in the urban legend or not. I think the movie cares about unsatiable ambition that drives all three of the documentary. I think that's really their the focus, the part three of Chris's definition, the meaning.
It's very much a film, I think, about creative desire and anxiety and about wanting to make your mark on the world and about trying to figure out how you can make something that will impress. And because I think, I mean, especially with Gavin's character, he's trying so hard to show the world he's doing something good or that he's doing something important. And he's just like this really kind of like average white guy who's like grappling with like his own anxiety as a filmmaker. And what's really interesting is just from knowing people who've worked on this film before Eric passed away, like there was a lot of himself in that character too, in terms of trying to like figure out how to be a good filmmaker, how to make a mark, how to like, you know, make something worthwhile. And I think this film is, especially because everyone, all of our characters are filmmakers, it's people just going, and I think a lot of found footage actually deals with this. I think found footage is a really fascinating subgenre that deals with the desire to be a storyteller and what happens when you try, when you really like are desperate to be a storyteller and finding that story and the lengths you'll go to find your story. And I think this is one of the more effective found footage films that grapples with that too as well. I still think Peeping Tom is real, and I think this is an in the world of the movie, not actually like in real life, but I think it's a really interesting look at desperation and as creatives too.
I was thinking, going along with that line of thought, it's interesting that I'm in the camp that the original film is, in the context of the movie, is a real and not a hoax. But so you have people making a film and then you have this other person coming in and trying to basically make a film off of the creative works, whether it's a hoax or whether it's real life. He's trying to make a film off of the creative works of someone else. And then you have a documentary crew that is trying to make a film based off of someone who is also trying to. So it's like all these people are in a way using their subject matter, their subject matter to further their career. Because at one point at the end of the movie, we have the documentarian saying, we don't have an ending. We need to have this play out some way. So like everyone is very fascinated with trying to sell their version of this story vice actually telling the story as it played out originally. And so I think there's some interesting meta commentary there on the way in which filmmakers can utilize other people's work.
Absolutely. I think that like career and selling is really at the heart of that creative anxiety. Cause like, you know, who doesn't have creative anxiety? Like the people on the street who are having fun sharing the story, the like paranormal investigator group that like seem to get along really well together. And like, what seems to be driving the anxiety for all of these characters is like being the person who gains something by both career and wealth from it. Like Feldman and I'm sorry, what was her name again?
The Sophia, right?
Sophia and Feldman, right? They're constantly fighting over that, like, who gets an award, like who gets credit, like who is the director. And like, that's Gavin's whole drive is like, I have to be a guy who makes a film and it's my film and I'm the famous guy. And like Terry is saying, like with the documentary crew, like they're so worried about like, I need to make this into a packageable, sellable thing. So in a way, they're not, none of them actually are really storytellers because they're not actually interested in the story as much as like the commodified package of the story. Whereas the people who treat them like actual legends can sort of subsume themselves into the community and enjoy the telling of the story and the sharing of the story because they don't care about their specific individual name being above anybody else's.
I think that's such a good point. I think it's also worth pointing out that like, even if you proved this Peeping Tom footage was real, we had that aliens thing where the guy went up in Congress and testified that aliens were real and like we knew about them and nobody cared. No one made any money on any of that. So I think this footage, even if Gavin did prove it to be real or Eric Myers did or Sophia, if any of them had proved it, it wouldn't have given them the thing they wanted. They would have still been sitting there with the insatiable ambition to be the famous filmmaker, to make the money, to drive the nice car. They wouldn't get those things out of it.
That's the real horror.
Capitalism's the real horror.
Yeah. Ain't that the fucking truth?
I think they had great naturalistic casting and performances, and it seemed like no one was wearing any makeup, and it really sold the fiction of the story. It really gave it some verisimilitude, convinced me it was real.
Oh, yeah. Well, especially like, especially when Eric starts coming into the movie and like they're looking for Gavin. You're like, at one point I was like, it did make me pause. Like, wait, hold on a second. What the fuck is going on? So like paired with the performances and the way they didn't like try to make these look like actors, I think they've really hit that naturalism like sweet spot. No one felt like, and again, I think found footage can have really awkward performances, but I don't think this one didn't have that. And like we mentioned previously, like, some of the performances from people who aren't actors were actually pretty impressive and made them feel like, oh, they're not performing. They're just dudes being like, what do you want from me? Please stop.
Yeah, the Gavin and Michael York argument felt to me like if you told me that that was not a scripted scene, but Gavin was just instructed to go in there and get him to argue with you, I'd be like, yeah, that's what happened. I believe that 100%.
Yep. All right, you're going to go fight Eduardo Sanchez. Have fun. Bye.
There are multiple times where I'm like, did they set up like punk style interviews with these like experts where they didn't know at first? And then afterwards, they're like, sorry, dude, we were pulling your leg. This guy I know.
That was my thought too. I was wondering that too. I was like, before I knew, I was like, what? I don't know. What? Because sometimes when people act like they're really angry, I'm like, wait, did they fuck with them? Like, for real?
I know.
I love this movie. I'm so glad you guys liked it. I was like, if we're going to watch a weird one to pair with a big one, why not? A footage
movie. Did any of you try to butterfly kiss someone after watching this movie?
Why would
we need to know what it feels like.
We wear glasses.
Podcast purposes.
I mean, like, oh my God.
I had pink eye when I watched this movie, so I did not.
Because a butterfly kisses shields. Wait, hold on. Do glasses protect you from the peeping?
Oh, fuck, yeah.
I think Tom can't get you if you have glasses.
I was like, what about contacts? It's technically not the lens of my eye.
True.
You
get
a guy with glasses, would you?
Don't bully me.
That's the way to beat Peeping Tom.
Have horrible vision and wear glasses all the time. That... amazing.
Sorry, Terry. The rest of us are safe. Sure.
Oh, I'm wearing contacts. Oh,
he wears glasses. Oh, no, perfect. He wears glasses. The thing was that was so funny is like my dad's mom, who's passed away, we used to give each other butterfly kisses. So now I like, because I used to call them Eskimo kisses, which,
oh yeah,
you know, not like the best things to call things as a child, but here we are. But it was like, it was butterfly kisses and Eskimo kisses with the note, like when you're touching noses. And now I will never, ever be able to think of doing butterfly kisses. It had like a very cute like name to me. I will never do it. Also,
I didn't know that was a thing.
You did? I don't know. Weird family things, but.
I think we got into the bulk of it, but I would love to end on a quote from the filmmaker. I think that'd be really sweet. It's a little long, so strap in. It's not too long, actually. So when asked about like what was like the aim for this film, and this, I think that the aim that that Meyer set out to do, I think that he accomplished it. But in his own words, the end result was for audiences to perhaps buy into the temporary notion that Butterfly Kisses, via its casting of public figures playing themselves, might be a real documentary about presumably fake found footage. Just as important was for audiences to see the end credits and realize the documentary was just a ruse, but to potentially believe that the urban legend itself was real. The manufacturing of historical data would reinforce this belief. This has already shown to be working, as I've done numerous interviews during the film festival tour, or listened to interviews with festival showrunners, during which the urban legend is being accepted as completely legitimate due to the straight-faced on-screen treatment of the subject, as well as the existence of straight-faced online literature. So again, just well done. Very well thought out. What a interesting conceit and just like commitment to the bit. My favorite thing. So yeah, just wanted to put that in there.
Great job of like having a film where you can see it from both ways. So yes, other than the way that we were saying, Candyman did not pull off.
Exactly. Yeah.
Thanks everyone for coming on. Does anybody have anything they would like to plug?
Yeah, I do. And I know that Terry probably does. So first and foremost, follow our podcast and listen to our podcast. We put out new episodes on Mondays and Fridays. Mondays are our usual interview episodes with a guest, and Fridays are our little cut episodes where we talk about what we've been watching. You can follow us on social media. We're at Scarred Podcast on Twitter and Blue Sky, and at Scarred for Life Podcast on Instagram. We also have Patreon that we're going to open back up soon. You can also follow me on Twitter and Blue Sky at MB McAndrews, Instagram at MB.McAndrews. I post all kinds of shit. I made a movie that's coming out next year at some point. So follow that. If you're into rape revenge movies, we're people get murdered for being assholes. That's pretty cool. And then Dread Central is my child and my baby. So follow that on all the platforms and look at all the cool stuff that people write for us, including some of the people on this podcast.
I got nothing. I'm at Gaily Dreadful everywhere. You can find my writing at Gaily Dreadful and other places. And then Mary Beth covered the podcast perfectly. Got nothing to add.
Well, thank you both for joining us again. This was great. We got deep, we got silly, we got messy, which is honestly the best way to get about urban legend. So thank you.
I don't think there's any other way to do it.
Yeah.
Yes. Chris, where can people find you online?
Where
can we find you?
Right.
I'm on social media, but I don't really post much. It'll just be like, here is like random socialist thing or basketball thing that I retweeted. So you can find me if you want to. Beyond that,
I'll not rest until you have 10,000 followers. I will rest.
He would hate that. He hates social media.
I'm working on a horror novel, almost done. So if anybody is a person who publishes those things, hit me up in a couple of months.
You can find me here and on Patreon and at RyanB4890 on X. Cass, do you have any cool projects that just got released? Maybe a book that got published?
Yeah. So my debut queer horror novella, The Caretaker, is out from Hero Scream Press, everybody. It's been cool so far getting some feedback. The books have finally shipped. There's a slight delay, so I'm sorry if it took your book a while to get there, but it's probably there now if you're listening to this now. And thank you for reading.
I ordered my physical copy because I read it, but then I bought it on my Kindle, and then I bought a physical copy, even though I already had the reader copy.
Appreciate that. Oh, and I'm on X for as long as I guess there is there.
website we usually go to.
That had all this out. At class, I can't even say my name. Fuck it. I'm not going to put in my handle. I'm going to edit this out. I will still be there. Who knows?
Get in.
No. Okay. All right. We're done.
Woo! Thanks for listening.
Xing out of this conversation.
Oh my God.
So you may have listened to the music in this episode and wondered why it wasn't creepier. I decided instead of trying to sound creepy, I would go with three pieces of little music referenced urban legends in music. So the first is a blues lick inspired but legally distinct from the work of Robert Johnson, a blues guitarist who is rumored to have sold his soul to the devil at the crossroads. The second one is a Picardy's Third, which I thought was funny because a college friend roommate had told me that people did the Picardy's Third to stop the devil from coming out after they played music. It turns out that is not true, and he was joking, but I thought it was very funny and a little encapsulation of how urban legends spread. And the last one, which I think you may have actually gotten the thing from, the idea of the devil,
is called the Devil's Chord, which when you go from like an E to a B flat, meaning you go three whole steps away from your tonic chord, and it sounds terrible, so they called it the Devil's Chord. I hope you enjoyed this. Thanks for listening.